Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fregal Byrne. Every week I speak to leading sustainability thinkers and practitioners, scientists, economists, NGOs, business leaders and investors. We discuss the sustainability imperative, the key challenges, the latest thinking, and what's working in sustainability, resilience and regeneration. Thank you very much, Rob, for joining me today on the Sustainability Agenda podcast.
I'm delighted to be here. It's a great show.
So I'm really looking forward to talking to you about your fantastic book, Slow Violence, and I also about your evolving ideas and research. It's a few years now, quite a few years the book is out, and I know you're working on other projects and you've continued that research. Can you maybe just by way of introduction tell us a little bit about your background and your current work focus?
Sure. So I grew up in South Africa and was passionate about ornithology as a kid and a teenager, and I was pretty certain I would become an ornithologist. And then by the time I did my undergraduate degree, and I majored in African languages and literature at a place called Rhodes University, by that stage I had sort of fallen into a deeper realization of exactly how the politics of landscape in South Africa had been constituted in terms of apartheid. And so, I mean, the writer Nadine Gordimer talks about falling through the South African way of life. And so at the time under apartheid, South Africa was fairly isolated. The TV was banned in its entirety. And particularly as a kid, you grow up with a sense of semi-normalcy. Whatever surrounds you, that's your world. And my parents were fairly liberal, but it was not really until I plunged into the realm of African languages and literature and made close black friends through that realm that I really came to a fuller sense of the degree to which my early environmental pleasures were in a sense corrupted by the politics of violence, displacement, and the land. And I had in many ways the opposite of in our family, the opposite of helicopter parenting. There were nine of us in the house, and you know, my parents often just wanted to shoo us outdoors. And you know, younger brother and I, when we were 11, 12, we would hear rumor that there was a leopard in a cave 20 miles away, and my mother would drive us there and drop us off and say, "I'll pick you up at this tree in 12 hours' time," you know, while you look for the leopard. And we used to supplement our meager allowances with collecting snakes and selling them to a snake park, you know, and some of them were poisonous. So it was a very unsupervised childhood, and I was particularly passionate about birds. But by the time I got to college, it was a very political time. The society was in a great state of upheaval. And so there were military call-ups for young white men, either after school or after college. And so after college, I felt I couldn't enter the military, and I left as a political exile. And so by now, I've lived most of my life in the U.S. I spent 5 years in the U.K., and I'm a citizen. I have a U.S. passport, a South African passport, and an Irish passport through my grandparents. So I've always lived kind of comparatively, and I've always had this very strong interest in justice questions of social justice. But for a long time, when I was a graduate student at Columbia, and then when I continued to teach there for 8 or 9 years, I took no interest in the environment whatsoever because it seemed incompatible with my broader interests in post-colonial studies, in questions of empire and justice. And I worked at the time, I did my dissertation under the supervision of the Palestinian-American Edward Said, who had a profound influence on me, both in thinking through questions of settler colonialism more broadly. He didn't have an environmental bone in his body, but he did think comparatively, and he helped me kind of globalize my perspective in invaluable ways. And then something happened. I had always taught African literature and post-colonial studies. And two things happened. One was in the late 80s and early 90s, living in New York, the big social trauma was HIV/AIDS. And we all knew friends and people we were close to who were dying and did die of AIDS, and we saw the rise of ACT UP and the successful attempts to reorient the research agenda to actually coming up with what were ultimately antiretrovirals and to remove the stigma of AIDS. And so some of what we're seeing with Trump and COVID resonates with Reagan and AIDS and the demonizing of people who wear face masks and the demonizing of people who are HIV positive. And a book that really influenced me a great deal was at the time was Derek Jarman's Modern Nature, where he, when he became HIV positive, he retreated to the Dungeness, the coast of Kent, in the shadow of the nuclear power station, and on those unpromising shingle beaches, created a garden for himself. And the Modern Nature is a diary of his decline, his loss of his sight, and ultimately his death. And one of the things that really struck me about that book was the way that he was trying to integrate something environmental like gardening with the nuclear question of nuclear power, and also with the fate of his own body in relation to HIV/AIDS. And then a couple of years after that, I got involved in a campaign to release an African writer who I'd taught called Ken Saro-Wiwa. He was a Nigerian activist who was opposing the despoiling of the Niger Delta by Shell and the Nigerian National Oil Company. And I had steeped myself in African literature and politics for many, many years, and I'd never heard of an African environmental writer, because in the context of Africa, environmentalism was very closely twinned with colonialism, and it was often seen as anti-human. These environmentalists come in to East Africa or Southern Africa, and the reputation is they like animals more than they like people. And yet with Ken Saro-Wiwa, the situation was that you had the equivalent of an Exxon Valdez oil spill through leakages from a very dilapidated pipe system, the equivalent of that kind of oil spill every year for about 30 years. And what Saro-Wiwa's genius was to recast what he initially fought as a struggle for the defense of his Ogoni people, a small micro minority of about 500,000 in Nigeria. He recast that in terms of environmental justice and started getting international traction once he connected human rights and environmental struggles. And so I think in 1995, when I was teaching at Columbia, I taught a course called Modern Nature, and I sort of bookended it with Derek Jarman on the Kent coast and Ken Saro-Wiwa in the Niger Delta, and started trying to find a way for myself and for the students to think together these questions of colonialism and racial injustice on the one hand, and environmental protections on the other. So that was really the beginning of my trajectory.
And you continue to do teach and research in the area in literature, and as well in this post-colonial environmental justice area.
Yes. So environmental justice has really been central to my work for the past 25 years, I would say. And my position at Princeton is a professor of environmentalism and humanities. And I'm very, very interested in the power of story and image to catalyze social movements. And so, you know, as the COVID crisis has illustrated so well, we need good data and we need better data. But the fact that we have that data does not mean that the data will translate into good public policy. And so I'm fascinated, and this is evident in Slow Violence and elsewhere in my work, I'm fascinated by the power of a meme or a story or an image to catalyze public sentiment and to translate scientific knowledge into powerful currents that ultimately strengthen social movement. So, I mean, just to take the current, I mean, to go back to the AIDS example, if we think of silence equals death and the pink triangle and the way that ACT UP used those symbols to mobilize and connect what many LGBTQ activists considered a kind of genocide by sloth, if you like, on the part of the Reagan administration, to connect that with the Holocaust. And if we think of two very, very powerful memes at the moment, Black Lives Matter and I Can't Breathe, when the people came up with those phrases, they couldn't have guessed that they would have gone viral and global and had such domino effects in so many societies. So I'm very interested in working in this interface between scientific data and public narratives, public stories, public images, and how we reach certain tipping points. That's really at the heart of my interests. Yeah.
Well, it's a fascinating topic, and I spoke to Catherine Hayhoe recently, mm-hmm. who spends a lot of time thinking about that. And it's a recurring theme in many of the interviews, is how the environmental movement, I guess, in various ways has managed to tell the story of the challenges we're facing and the role the scientists play, and some of the very challenging issues at the heart of the climate crisis and reasons why it is a wicked problem, complex and difficult to translate into action or motivate people to take action, and various different layers there, and this question of slow violence I think is very important. But maybe just first, I like to just get a sense at the beginning, we face no shortage of environmental and social other problems, and not to mention the immediate coronavirus crisis, but what in particular is on your mind right now?
So yeah, three things really. I mean, we are living in, needless to say, an extraordinary time. And in the US, what we have is three things going on. We have the COVID crisis, we have the epicenter of the Black Lives Matter movement, and we have the run up to the November election. And I think if we look at these three together, they all are profoundly consequential for the future of environmental policy and environmental transformation. And I think not only in the US, but globally. I mean, it's arguable that US elections are so consequential that every citizen on earth should have a vote in them. because of fallout for defunding the WHO to shredding various, defecting from the Paris Accord and so forth. I mean, they're very, very consequential. And so what we're seeing with COVID is semi-analogous to what we're seeing with climate science denialism, which is the casting of science in the US by a very significant and powerful minority, the casting of science as elitist and as anti-freedom. And I don't know of any other society in which this body of thought and activism is as powerful as in the US. It's diminishing, I think, particularly generationally. The younger generation buy into it less. But it's not just an ideology, it's a set of think tanks. It's, hundreds of millions of dollars that are invested in either denying climate science or in pretending that there are large constituencies of experts who are uncertain about whether climate breakdown is occurring or not. And so that some of the legacy of that anti-science ideology has implications for the completely derelict response to COVID. And this in turn connects up with the Black Lives Matter movement, because in terms of the structural violence and the slow violence of poverty and discrimination that are the continuing legacy of slavery and the seizure of native lands in this country, we see the unequal burdens of health risks fall most heavily on the poor, who in this country, in the US, are disproportionately African American, Latina, and Native populations. And so, I mean, the one encouraging thing I feel about all of this is that if we look at the longer history of environmentalism in the US, it started out very much as a wilderness-driven movement. By most country standards, the U.S. is very lightly populated, and the ideology of conservation was very much grounded in the idea of preserving spaces where people were not, or where very few people were. But in an urbanizing world, and if we're thinking of societies that are densely populated, China, India, Nigeria, Indonesia, even the UK by comparison, that wilderness model cannot be the dominant model for environmentalism going forward. And so what I've seen over the last, I would say, 10, 15 years in particular, is environmental justice moving from the margins much closer to the center of environmentalism. And so we see this in the COVID movement, in the COVID phenomenon and the Black Lives Matter movement, this very strong overlap between environmental concerns and public health concerns. So access to healthcare, access to breathable air, to drinkable water. These are very, very pressing concerns for the poor, and it complicates a perception of environmentalism that certainly was there in the early days when I started working in these areas, a perception that environmentalism is a kind of a boutique issue for the well-off, because they don't suffer the exigencies of day-to-day survival that the poor experience. Now, clearly, with climate change and rising oceans, rising temperatures, the poor are living in the front lines of those dramatic transformations. And so if you're in Bangladesh or on a small island like the small islands like the Maldives or in the Pacific, climate breakdown is not an issue that is the province of the rich. It's right there in your face, already happening. And so that I think is one of the most encouraging dimensions to the environmental movement that I see now, is a great diversification of the kinds of stories and the kinds of imaginative and political energies that are coming to the movement from quarters where people might previously have thought, oh, you know, environmentalists live in London or Geneva or San Francisco, and they come here and they impose their agendas. But instead, I think we're having very powerful new currents of environmental activism and thought that are rooted in local knowledges, be they urban or be they rural, and that includes very much the environmentalism of the poor.
Very interesting. In your book, you spend you analyze and you talk about and introduce some fantastic range of thinkers, very committed thinkers, writing about the environment in various different ways. I'm just wondering, could you talk a little bit about, and this is something, a recurring theme, I guess, in your work and interest, in the importance of culture in how we think about the environmental questions and how that leads to action. And you talked about the AIDS crisis back under Reagan and so forth. But I'm just wondering more generally in terms of cultural values and how that evolves. Because clearly today we live in a much more multimedia culture. You talk about memes and it is impressive the way some of these ideas have spread so fast and are so powerful. But just as my way of a kind of backdrop to these questions, if that makes sense.
Mm, it does, yes. So culture has a profound impact, and there, it's not possible, I think, for any community to live anywhere without developing a body of environmental knowledge, which is integral to their chances of survival. And that knowledge is transmuted as it's transmitted across generations. And I think one of the things that we are seeing now is a greater openness to different genealogies of environmentalism. So that if you're Adivasi living, forest people living in India, you have a particular set of relations to the forest. In the Amazon, they would be different. If you're in the Sahel or if you're living in Harlem, you have a certain set of cultural values and a body of knowledge that are located in that place. And so I think there was a time when the idea was that environmentalism was kind of top down and that you had to teach poorer people to respect their environments and so forth. Okay. But what we see with say, just to take one example, Wangari Maathai, who was one of the founders of the Greenbelt movement in Kenya that ultimately planted something like 100 million trees across East Africa. If we think of somebody like her, she was rooted in a rural Kenyan culture where her grandmother said to her, when you go out to collect firewood, don't touch the fig trees, because the fig trees have this vast rooting system that holds the banks in place. And if you cut down the fig trees, the banks will collapse, the river won't be shaded, and it will dry up and it will affect our capacity to get water. And she then went on to get a PhD in biology and to found the social movement that tapped into a deep local cultural knowledge of tree cultures in Kenya and helped generate a kind of civil rights movement from the planting of trees. So the planting of saplings was was used as a cultural weapon, a symbolic weapon, a non-violent weapon against a very violent Kenyan regime under Arap Moi, who were felling the public forests and turning them into golf courses and estates for cabinet ministers and so forth. So the role of culture and the role of symbolism in making public statements that can be expressive of deep-held cultural values, I think is quite profound. And we see this, I think we've seen this also with a recent turn towards paying more attention, and I think this is global, to indigenous voices and currents of indigenous knowledge that are less perhaps arrogant in their relations to the environment, to the earth, and also that in many instances offer a longer time frame, an intergenerational time frame, cultural values that say in a sense are antithetical to the extremes of neoliberalism, whereas the impetus is towards instantaneous profit without thought for what's going to happen downwind. And so I think there are these cultural shifts, and culture has a profound, sometimes very often incalculable role to play in transformation of what constitutes environmentalism and environmental possibility. Just one last example, we could go back to Rachel Carson and Silent Spring, and JFK coming to the podium, giving a speech and having a copy of Silent Spring in his hand and saying, we're going to look at the toxic fallout in agribusiness and so forth. So a book like that captured the public imagination, and at a time when I think there were only 3 TV channels in America, hard to believe, but 1/10 of the entire American population sat down at the same time for 1 hour to watch the TV documentary on Silent Spring, and that had a profoundly transformative effect on environmental consciousness as it shifted, helping it shifted away from a conservation only focus towards something closer, like closer to environmental justice. And as a result, I think that Carson's seminal book played a very big role in the wave of environmental legislation that followed in the late 60s and the early 70s in the US, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Endangered Species Act, the Wilderness Act, formation of the Environmental Protection Agency. Many of the institutions and acts that are currently being unraveled under Trump were largely instigated by cultural events like the publication of Carson's book, and then in 1970, Wisconsin's Gaylord Nelson instituting Earth Day, which became an annual and international phenomenon. So, I don't think we can underestimate the role of culture in creating these tipping points in consciousness and even ultimately in public policy.
If I could ask one question here about, we've seen tremendous growth in social media, which has been a mixed blessing in many ways. Yes. Yet you see on Twitter and so forth, you see a lot of voices. I guess there seems to be increasing awareness that the mainstream media very often represents corporate financial interests, and there's a tremendous amount of distrust, which also taps into other ways in which distrust has been, I guess, fueled and so forth. But I'm just wondering whether you have, just finally on the cultural side of things, any thoughts on maybe the media, and also I mentioned just in film, I mean, you spend a lot of time looking at writers and literature, but clearly cinema is very capital intensive, but it's also very, very powerful. But just any reflections on or observations on how you see that kind of cultural impact?
Yes, it's profound. I mean, if we think of the short video of George Floyd, and the fact that without cameras on our phones, so many accounts would have been discredited as they were in the past, accounts of violence. To take another recent instance, which may or may not have resonated internationally, but there was a fellow called Christian Cooper, who was a black bird watcher. The very day that George Floyd was murdered, Christian Cooper was bird watching in Central Park, and where dogs are supposed to be on their leash, and a woman approached him with a dog unleashed, and he asked her to leash it, and she called 911 and said an African American man was assaulting her in the park, threatening her and assaulting her in the park, and he caught that on his phone. And one of the things that reminds me of is a video that also went viral maybe 6-7 years ago by a black ornithologist called Drew Lanham, who teaches in the South in South Carolina, and it's called Nine Rules for the Black Birder. And basically, what he's doing is dramatizing in that little maybe 4-minute video. The difference between being a white birder and a black birder. And so he says, the rules are never wear a hoodie, take at least 3 forms of ID. Best bird watching is at dawn and dusk. If you're creeping around in the woods in camouflage gear with binoculars and you're black, you're a suspect. And so he laid out the differences for a black person and a white person, simply being passionate about birds and how you have to develop that spatial awareness. And so if we watch that, and then 7 years later we watch Christian Cooper's video, we can see the sort of prescience of Lanham's insights. And he talked about when he was doing his PhD, he wanted to study a particular warbler that migrates from the deep south to the upper Midwest, Michigan. And then he looked at where he'd have to do his research in the swamps of the deep south. And his supervisor said to him, listen, your work may be famous, but it'll probably be posthumously famous. Because it's just such scary terrain for a black person. So what he did in determining how he was going to conduct his research was he took a map of the distribution of different warbler species in the United States, and he took another map of hate crimes, the distribution of hate crimes in the U.S. He superimposed them and chose a warbler that he would have to research in less dangerous territory, you know. And so, you know, to come back to your original point, I think these kinds of videos can, first of all, amplify the witnessing power of groups of people, be they African-Americans or women or the poor, whose voices have been historically discredited as witnesses. And they can allow for constituencies to galvanize very rapidly and produce kind of social pressure. The more difficult task is how do you translate those moments of digital massing into structural change? You know, how do we maintain if we like the slow resistance or the slow transformation, once the attention span has moved on, as it tends to very rapidly.
Yeah, that's very interesting what you say, because the examples also, you are dramatic and intense and emotional. And at the heart of your argument about slow violence is that the slow violence has none of those qualities and is very difficult to dramatize, I suppose, and to get people's attention. And to this is clearly at the heart of the climate crisis, which is a slow unfolding series of crises which seem far away and seem in somebody else's country, somebody else's world, and over unfolding over a very long time frame. Can you maybe just talk a little bit about what slow violence is, why it interests you, and how it helps thinking about environmental and climate justice?
Yeah, so actually I'd started off thinking about it in terms of the toxic aftermaths of war, things like depleted uranium, landmines. And I remember reading an article in the New York Times saying that during the Vietnam War, we, that is the US, were responsible for 1.5 million deaths. And so it was bracketed, that number was bracketed by the 12-year official expanse of the war. But I was very aware that the fallout from Agent Orange was intergenerational. Through biomagnification in the food chain, the toxins, the effect of the toxins were perpetuated, increasing even into the third generation risks of things like Alzheimer's, heart disease, and various other disabling conditions. And in Bien Ho, which was the center of the storage of Agent Orange and some of the Agent Orange deployment, the levels of toxicity 25 years after war's end were something like 140 times higher than in Ho Chi Minh City. So that was my context for thinking about how do we retain attention when the damage is continuing, but the event has ceased. And so the opposite extreme of slow violence would be something like 9/11, where it was unbelievable that it happened, but yet many Americans recognized its cinematic qualities in a sense. They'd been imaginatively prepared for it. Versus, say, for instance, the fact that the first responders at 9/11 there was this whole debate whether they should wear masks, you know, again, kind of prefiguring some of today's debates, whether they should wear masks, whether they were at risk of inhaling hazardous substances. And I remember Christy Whitman at the time saying, no, there's an all clear here. There are no health risks. And down the line, we have seen a tremendous number of people dying prematurely from various forms of lung disease and suffering for many, many years as a result of the absence of protective gear when they valiantly responded, many of them just as volunteers, to the aftermath of 9/11. So that's a case of slow violence where that's no longer a catchy storyline. That happened way back then. But for people inhabiting those bodies, it is continuing to happen. So if we scale that up to the climate crisis, one of the most encouraging things I feel, and this is partly, you know, spending a lot of my time teaching people in the late teens and early 20s, is that for the younger generation, the question of climate breakdown and the question of intergenerational answerability is front and center. And we can see this in something like the Green New Deal, where you have a very tightly interwoven set of issues around intergenerational responsibility on the one hand, and what's often perceived by younger people as intergenerational theft. And so the question of student debt, climate debt, the impossibility of getting on the housing ladder, All of these questions are very much braided together in relation to a broader set of issues of distributive justice. And those issues have a profound temporal dimension that, well, I'm seeing more and more, and this is evidenced also in the polls among young people, is we can't keep kicking the can down the road. We are now creating the world that we, the young people, will inhabit. And we see this, for instance, in the debates among young people about the wisdom or even ethics of procreating.
Absolutely. Yes, the generational issue is tremendously important. And there's a wonderful book by Keir Milburn, I don't know if you've come across, called Generation Left, and looking at what's been happening in British politics. And
no, I don't know that, yeah.
Yeah, I'll send you a link. I spoke to him a few months ago, but it's about the impact of the younger generation and how that's changing and changing British politics. Not maybe fast enough, given our recent election history, but very interesting. Throughout your book, there's you can't get away from the impact of the economy, the impact of, well, a particular economic era, I guess, the neoliberal era, or the last 30 or 40 years, that was called the Great Acceleration, and I guess underlying that, capitalism more generally. And I'm just interested if you talk a little bit about that, and I guess linked to that is over this period is this emerging idea of the Anthropocene, which has become popular and growing interest in, and it focuses, I guess, at a species level almost of what humans are doing, while looking at if you look at it from an economic perspective, we can see the impact of an economic system, particularly over the last 30 or 40 years.
Yes, yes. No, you're absolutely right. That's central to my work, this question of neoliberalism and deregulation in particular, and the concentration of wealth. And so up until the 2007-2008 economic crash, this question of inequality and disparity, which has been growing in most societies for a good while, that question was largely seen as a sort of left-wing issue. Post-2007-2008, even on the right, politicians have had to grapple with it. And so this broader question of distributive justice, distribution across generations, distribution across races and gender distribution, this broader question of distributive justice has become interwoven with the question of environmental justice. And what we're seeing now, I think, with the complete mayhem of the response to COVID in the US and I think in the UK too, in a different cultural context, is a reminder that government can still play a role, that regulations play a role, that one needs you need to invest in precautionary institutions. And those very institutions that have been dismantled and defunded in the US and the UK are there to take care of precisely these emergencies. And you cannot reconstitute that expertise and those institutional networks overnight when a pandemic suddenly arises or when Hurricane Sandy hits. And so I think what we are seeing at the moment, both in generational terms and perhaps even more broadly, is a recognition in, at least in the American populace at large, that, hey, government does have a role. And this idea that was promulgated by Thatcher and Reagan and has, continued in various permutations since, that the best government is the smallest government, that you have to shrink government, is absolutely catastrophic. And that if we're to tackle something as big as COVID, or even bigger, climate breakdown, we do need cooperative structures. We need deep pools of expertise. We need well-funded, well-resourced civil services and hospitals and healthcare systems that are set up in an anticipatory way. It's simply not possible to respond retroactively if you have appointed, as in the US, people to direct these institutions whose primary remit is to dismantle them. And I think that is going to have a political fallout for this next election. I hope I'm not being over-optimistic, but I do think the perception of government itself and the role of government and perhaps recovering some of those social democratic values that have been gutted under a neoliberalism, perhaps we can hope for a turn in that direction. So to come to the second part of your question that was about the Anthropocene. I think one of the, I won't get into the various debates about when the Anthropocene started, I mean, and so forth, it can get a bit technical. But I think the basic idea of the Anthropocene is that, you know, for the first time in the history of the planet, we have a sentient species, namely Homo sapiens, that is having an impact on life on Earth that is roughly analogous to an asteroid strike. That we are geological actors, we're not simply historical actors. And we see this in our profound impact on the carbon cycle, the nitrogen cycle, the hydrological cycle, including the melting of the glaciers, the fact that 90% of vertebrate life today, which we've shipped around the globe, is human livestock, goats, I mean, cattle, pigs, goats, chickens, sheep. So it has profound biodiversity impact as well. And that our current actions will be legible in some cases for thousands or even hundreds of thousands of years in the fossil record. So, you know, I think imaginatively it can deliver a kind of a jolt. And one of the tensions that I sense in the culture is this tension between people asking us to think in vast geological terms, and at the same time, daily life is more and more lived sort of at a nanosecond level. I mean, if we think of even the way the trading floors and stock exchanges have changed, and the way that people flit constantly from interruption to interruption, and our idea of continuous time is so much more scattered and fragmented than it was. So I think the relationship between the digital and the Anthropocene is a very complicated one, and it's quite a difficult one to straddle. And climate change is like a scaled down version of the Anthropocene. We're talking a lot about, you know, what will the world look like in 2050, as opposed to in 3,000 years time.
Yes. You mentioned this optimism that you have, and I guess looking at things, there's been tremendous momentum, I guess, since you wrote your book, and not just at the younger generation in terms of awareness of climate change, but at the same time, things morph, and quite quickly you see, you know, the original idea that maybe the people would become aware that this was a challenge and therefore be open to solutions that, you know, that would deal with the roots of these issues and so forth. But actually you find that it's been kind of refabricated and rebuilt into, you know, what you might call climate fascism in some places. But really in terms of, they say, oh yeah, well, yeah, maybe climate change is happening, but actually, what we really need to do is, you know, close the borders and, you know, we need energy independence and all kinds of issues like that. So the it does seem that the forces that don't really want regulation and change like that are pretty powerful and mobile.
Yes, I think, I mean, one of the effects of neoliberalism and the kind of the what Arundhati called the vertical secession of the rich, this immense widening gap between the ultra rich and the uber poor, is that a lot of populations around the world feel abandoned and feel excluded. And the resulting populism can swing left or right in different circumstances, and depending how it's manipulated, it doesn't have an innate politics. But I think that the one possible fallout from COVID could be a wider recognition that societies cannot go it alone. So Trump's narrow jingoism, saying, you know, America's tested the most people, I mean, a bunch of deceits, but that America's tested the most people and that we're the most virtuous land in the history of humanity and so forth, ring hollow in the face of a pandemic that doesn't respect borders, and that a kind of involuted nationalism is not going to solve these kinds of problems. So it's a tussle, it's a political tussle, but I think at least in the US currently there is a swing somewhat to the left, or at least to left of center, given that it's a fairly conservative society in many ways. And I saw a statistic recently that 5% of Americans under 30 were excited by Joe Biden, but a great majority of them would vote for him. And I think one thing that has happened as a result of Trump's extremism is a little bit of a shift to the left. And whatever the Democratic Party emerges as, it will have to take on board the priorities of this younger generation, the Green New Deal generation. And it cannot simply be a question of returning to the status quo ante, you know, to normal American electoral politics. At least that's my hope. And I do see some strong tendencies that even if Joe Biden's a kind of a placeholder, assuming he wins the presidency, he will have to surround himself with a very diverse, ethnically and generationally diverse group of experts and activists who will not return the party to the sort of center-right politics that prevailed before.
Well, that's a very big question, isn't it?
It is a big question, and I'm being speculative. I'm being optimistically speculative.
Yes, no, absolutely. And given his involvement and interest in foreign wars and so forth, but yeah, it's an evolving situation, isn't it? And you do see, you know, Spain's looking at the universal basic income, isn't it? And In the UK now, you see people starting to say, well, you know, that at least they'd like a 4-day week and things like that. I was talking to someone recently on the podcast who just said this is a moment of tremendous political possibility. And, you know, we're watching it, you know, and taking part and helping it what to give birth to something, but it's still unfolding. And maybe just, I'd be quite interested in just coming back to the writing side of it just before I'm mindful of the time. You know, in your book, showcase some wonderful, I guess, non-fiction writers talking about, writing about the environmental injustices and challenges and so forth. I'm just wondering also about the fiction, what you think is happening there. But firstly, I guess, have more writers been emerging, do you think? I mean, I guess it was 8 or 9 years ago. Is there more movement on that front? And you emphasize the non-fiction side, but I'm just also wondering about any fictional currents that you think are interesting.
Yes, I think in your correspondence with me, you'd mentioned Amitav Ghosh's The Great Derangement, where he talks about the struggle in sort of conventional realist fiction to portray something as epic as climate breakdown, And the scale of let's call it the dominant tradition of European and American realism struggles to cope with something larger than landscape. And he talks about the tradition of the epic, the oral epic, which continues today in many societies, where you have the weather and the gods and these vast forces that in some sense are more analogous to the forces of the Anthropocene. And so, you know, he's been called to task in some quarters for not focusing enough on speculative fiction or science fiction and fantasy. And I do see, for instance, in a lot of the new writing around, say, Afrofuturism, which is much of which is quite indebted to someone like Octavia Butler, who was writing these environmentally inflected futuristic novels decades ago. But there are these waves of Afrofuturist writers who fold environmental themes into both utopian and dystopian novels about transformed worlds. Think of Gemma, writer called Jemison, and a whole slew of younger writers who are, there's a wonderful book called Lagoon set in Nigeria, which blends this question of rising waters and sort of alternate forms of governance that transcend the possibilities of the present. So I do think that there's a lot of that writing emerging, even if we go back to something like, which we wouldn't normally think of as literary, but it's quite poetic, the Pope's encyclical Laudato Si, where he talks about the cry of the earth and the cry of the poor, and talks quite specifically about intergenerational theft. There is, in a surprising, unexpected religious context there, a grappling with other ways of imagining a path forward. And so I think this broader question of imagination, whether it's through films, through memes, through video clips, whether it's through encyclicals or Afrofuturism, this question of imagination is going to continue to play a profound role as we pursue plausible paths forward that offer us more hope and more sustenance.
Wow, that's fascinating, this question of the future. And I know some writers have been talking about this question that we can't imagine a future, or it ties in with various ideas, quotes about easier to imagine the end of capitalism,
right?
The end of the world and the end of capitalism. But generally, this challenge, the difficulty of imagining futures and so forth. But very interesting, very interesting. Well, what's next for you, Bob?
Well, I'm working on a book tentatively titled "Environmental Martyrs and the Fate of the Forests," and so I'm fascinated by the relationship between humans and trees. As we know, the great tropical forests of the earth are absolutely vital for carbon capture, for stabilizing the climate, for stabilizing the hydrological cycles. If we think of urbanization, we think of the place of trees in cities, the role of trees in reducing the trauma of increasing temperatures and so-called heat islands in concrete cities. And so humans and trees have always had this very long, deep, imaginative connections. I mean, if we think of the crown of the tree or the limbs of a tree, or people being rootless, there's these cross currents, imaginative cross currents between trees and humans. But my focus in the book is very largely on forest defenders in the tropics, who many of whom have sacrificed their lives in defense of forests that represent a set of cultural values as well. So these are activists in everywhere from Brazil to Honduras to Congo, Indonesia, Philippines, working as I usually do in the global south, where many of these environmental challenges are, if anything, more acute than they are in the richer nations. So I'm interested in this question of the sort of sacrificial figure of the environmental martyr, these land defenders and biodiversity defenders, who in an anticipatory way know that they're going to be killed, many of them, and yet stand up for those values in defense of the forests that are the very condition of their life, and that in a broader sense are also the ground of our planetary stability in many ways.
That's a tremendously important, urgent question. I wish you the very best of success with your writing and your research, and thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your great work.
Thank you, Fergal. It's been a great pleasure.
Yeah, that was brilliant. I really enjoyed that. Hope that was okay from your end.
That was great, really. Yeah, no, it was freewheeling, and I think we covered a lot of ground. So
Yeah. Well, it's the forest thing. I was just reading. I've got interested in Alexander Coburn and some of his writings, and just reading a very interesting long obituary, I guess, written by Perry Anderson, which is fascinating in the New Left Review. But was looking at some of his books, and the history of the Amazon.
Yes, with what's her name, Susanna
Hecht.
Susanna Hecht. Yes, that's right.
Yeah, she's doing some really interesting work as well. She's got a few books out that I was just looking at the last couple of days. It's been on my mind.
Yeah. No, I mean. Coburn was a force. He really was a force.
Yes. He just one slight problem at the end. He kind of missed the whole global warming thing and got a bit stuck in. But that work on fascinating about the history of the Amazon and I just think it's I was reading that the article you sent as well. It's very powerful Well, good luck with all of that.
Yes, well, it's terrific. Thanks for the invitation. And it was lovely to talk to you. And it's a really great series you're running.
Yeah, thank you so much. Good luck.
Okay.
I'll be in touch again when I get it. I'll send you the link to the Keir Milburn book. And actually, I did an interview with him as well. But yeah, fantastic.
Okay.
Let's keep in touch. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Fergal.
Thank you so much of your time. Thanks.
Okay.
Bye.
You take care. Bye.
Yeah, bye. Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. It would be great if you could leave a review and share the podcast on social media. You can sign up at iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.